Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Danae Wolf, author of the new book, Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist's Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. We all know that it's time to start working with nature in our backyards to protect biodiversity, and Grass Isn't Greener by conservation educator Danae Wolf is an approachable guide to the small actions you can take at home to make a difference in the world. With easy-to-follow advice and real-life examples, this must-have primer is built around 20 steps that anyone can take starting today. Danae Wolf is an award-winning conservation photographer, writer, educator, and founder behind the @ChasingBugs social media handle, focused on fostering appreciation and stewardship of backyard bugs and wildlife. Ever the pragmatic, she believes that everyone has the power to make a difference in combating global change and biodiversity loss. For more information, you can visit her website, which is www.chasingbugs.com. Now that, I'd like to welcome Danae to the show. Good, Danae.
Good day. I'm so excited to be here, Robert.
Thank you. And as I mentioned just before we came on, I love your photography.
It is
wonderful, and you have some awesome photos throughout your book. So people who want to buy your book, not only will they get good advice, but they'll really get a treat for the eyes looking at those photos.
Yes, yeah. The photography was a really big endeavor as part of the book. I did almost all the photography myself, and it was important because I like to show people what it is that they're protecting. It's about more than just, hey, go out and plant native plants, but it's plant native plants for these incredible creatures that you're going to ultimately be supporting.
Yeah, it is great. And while I was preparing for today's show, I went to your website and I noticed you had a movie that you had created a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I loved in that movie was the children. You know,
yes.
You could see the joy in the faces of the children when they were out in nature.
Yeah, I love that. You know, kids have this innate curiosity about nature in general, but also about things like insects. And I think somewhere along the line, we tend to lose that. And we tend to sort of replace it with fear and, you know, ooh, bugs are icky. We need to get rid of them. We need to bring back that childlike curiosity, the awe, the wonder. And I think that can kind of help create the foundation for wanting to protect these creatures and what we can do in our home landscapes to do just that.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think one of the movies that being closer to the bugs made him less afraid, and that was, I think that was very telling.
Yes, it is.
Tell us about you. When did you get interested in bugs?
Yeah, so I think this might come as a surprise to people, but I haven't always loved insects. I grew up with a fear of most insects, but a particular fear of spiders. I had really severe arachnophobia growing up. And, you know, I got my first camera. This was back in the film days. My parents bought me my first camera when I was around 12. And I began photographing flowers in particular and stayed in the realm of mostly like botanical portraits is what I like to call them for about 10 years until my early 20s when I got my first macro lens. And I started to get really up close and personal with the flowers that I had spent the previous 10 years photographing and started to take notice of the bugs, the bees, the butterflies, the grasshoppers, and started to just gain this, again, sort of childlike wonder and curiosity about these creatures that I had lived my whole life around but never really took notice of before. At the same time, I was pursuing my undergraduate degree in environmental studies at a small college here in Ohio. And paired with this newfound love of macro photography and now this sort of learning about local ecology, I started to realize, oh my gosh, nature's all around me. It's always been all around me. I've never appreciated backyard nature before, but look at all of these species that are here right underfoot that I've never noted before. And that really just kind of kickstarted this love and desire to want to kind of shout from the rooftops that, like, look at all these wonderful creatures that we should be protecting and noticing and appreciating. And from there have just sort of grown this little initiative, Chasing Bugs, and a lot of education and outreach.
Well, that's great. You know, and I could see how, you know, the progression. Why is it important that people take ownership and manage their backyards?
Yeah, so traditional landscape management is very heavy-handed, right? We deploy a lot of very carbon and water-intensive practices to maintain monocultures of turf grass that provide very little by way of ecological benefits and ecological services. They provide very few opportunities for shelter and food for wildlife. You know, we as humans have kind of rendered ourselves very deliberately separate or apart from nature. And we need to rethink that. Our yards can do so much for biodiversity and for climate. You know, we have about 40 million acres of turf grass here in the U.S. alone. And a huge portion of that is caught up in our own yards. And, you know, a lot of people want to place the blame on things like agriculture and say, well, you know, habitat loss is happening because of urbanization and development and agriculture. And those are all true. But when I think about ag in particular, you know, we are growing food for a growing global population. Our backyards are not doing that, right? So how can we help restore the native plants in our own backyards in ways that support the native wildlife, in ways that support the ecosystem, create the climate resiliency? I mean, we can look at our weather patterns, you know, even this week with increasing tornadoes and severity of storms, severity of droughts that lead to things like increase in wildfires. There are so many things happening as a result, and we all have an opportunity to play our part in helping to reduce this. So our own backyards, our own communities, maybe you don't live in a house with a yard, but maybe you're a renter in an apartment. Everything that we do contributes positively or negatively to the environment. So I always ask people, like, what can you do to kind of take that step in the right direction? How can we help empower people? You know, climate change tends to be marked by messaging of urgency and really large-scale global action, which can feel, I think, inherently disempowering for individuals. Taking some of that power back and saying, listen, I have a part to play, and that's going to be in my own backyard or my own community, I think is a really powerful alternative message.
Yeah, it is. And it's nice to be able to feel like you're making a contribution, you know, and recognizing, even though it may appear to the individual as being just a small kind of contribution, if many, many people did it, the results would be magnificent.
That's just it. It's a collective action, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just about one person putting some native plants in their yard. Yes, that can be a benefit, especially when we're talking about the scale of things like insects, right? Putting 10 native plants in your yard can support a whole ecosystem of bees and butterflies and other critters. But now imagine if we magnify that and everyone in a whole neighborhood or everyone in a whole, you know, community or state or around the whole nation begins to think and operate that way. All of a sudden, the impact is amplified, and we create really large-scale impact that way.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, you mentioned agriculture, the business of agriculture. I found it interesting when I was going through video, the film that you had made, there was mentioned that homeowners use twice as much insecticide as commercial business. I was stunned, you know, that, I mean, because when you think about pesticides, quite often, you know, one's mind would jump to big business, you know, and you know, big pesticide kind of usage. Mm-hmm. But it seems that the homeowners have more of an impact in that area.
Yeah, I mean, we're applying as homeowners more pesticides per acre than farmers are applying to their farms. And again, what is it in the pursuit of? In agriculture, we're getting food for a growing global population. And in our backyards, we're growing what I like to call as botanical statues, right? It's oftentimes these ornamental plants. Sometimes it might even be, you know, plants that are native here. They might not even be like problem plants. Maybe they're non-native, but they're not known to be invasive. Maybe we planted them in the wrong environment, so they require a more heavy-handed or resource-intensive practice to keep them alive, right? We're planting turf grass, for example, in the arid West, where turf grass shouldn't be growing, mm-hmm. and yet we're irrigating the heck out of it just to keep it alive. So it's about planting the right stuff in the right place. We can reduce those inputs like fertilizers and pesticides by doing that, while also, again, restoring that ecosystem function that has been oftentimes lost in our suburban and urban neighborhoods in particular.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. Now, one of the topics you cover is the idea of having an emotional shift from perfection to wild beauty in yard design. So it seems to me, you know, having an emotional shift, I mean, first of all, you know, that's really what leads to action most often is emotions. But also it seems like that might be one of the hardest things to change.
It is one of the hardest things to change, which is why I think this movement is pretty slow moving. We still are very culturally and societally attached to turf grass landscapes. And if we begin to understand and redefine what beauty looks like in the home landscape, if we stop looking at perfection as being an indicator of beauty, right? I go out and I see nothing but these perfect leaves and perfect petals, you know, as opposed to I go out and I see these little holes chewed in my leaves. That to me is beautiful because it created a connection. It created shelter or food for something. That to me is my marker of beauty and the marker that, hey, I'm doing something right. But in far too many, I think, urban and suburban landscapes, what has marked beauty is nothing but a weed-free, pest-free carpet of green grass. And it's a marker of almost like superiority. And it's very, I think, caught up in this sort of idea of classism too, right? We are attached to lawns because they represent, you know, a higher class or almost elitism. So we're just so tied to that. We're so, I think, afraid of moving away from it because we're worried about what other people might think. You know, are we just lazy about our landscape? This is where being really intentional about our decisions can help. You know, I have some signs in my garden that talk about, you know, the certified pollinator habitat or certified firefly habitat, certified wildlife garden, to kind of let the neighbors know we're not just being lazy. Like, this is all intentional, and we're doing it for the benefit of the plant.
Well, that's great, and that's educational, too, so that's a good thing. You know, one, I lived in California for many years, and then was being courted by a company to South Carolina. And one of the things, part of the trying to get me to move here, one of the, quote, better neighborhoods, you know, and I mean, I was just amazed. There was, you know, one huge, perfectly manicured lawn after another, you know, and it was like, I mean, when I looked at it, do you ever use that? You know, I mean, why do you have such a, I mean, I can understand, you know, it was like a status symbol.
Mm-hmm. It is a status symbol. Yeah. And it's so interesting when I talk to people, they're like, you know, I rarely see people using their lawn. It's not like we're maintaining these wide open spaces with very little plant life. Because, you know, people are out using the lawn. We're maintaining them simply to maintain them because, again, they're sort of this aesthetic that we have grown very fond of, and we need to shift away from that. So much of this is that emotional mindset shift and sort of redefinition of what it means to be beautiful, what it means to live as part of nature and sort of distinctly apart from it.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the topics in your book is how less lawn can support pollinators and biodiversity. So here we are talking about lawns, big lawns. So talk about how maybe less lawn can support pollinators.
Yeah, so it's really the idea that we want to start to kind of systematically think about where we can reduce the overall size of our lawn and instead replace it with a pallet of native plants. And when we say native plants, we're talking about plants that are native to your ecoregion. And you can very easily go online and just do a simple search for, you know, what is my ecoregion? A lot of organizations like Pollinator Pathway, Xerces Society, National Wildlife Federation, they all offer amazing plant lists that are curated specific to your ecoregion. Some of them, I think Pollinator Pathway, you can just put in your zip code and it'll spit out the right guide for you. So it's very easy. Those plants are going to basically be the plants that have co-evolved for millennia alongside wildlife that's native to your region. So a lot of different, especially as we look at like bee species, a lot of them are specialists. We think about the monarch butterfly, a specialist that relies on, of course, milkweed. So we need milkweed if we want monarchs. We need a lot of these very specific species of plants if we want to support a diversity of wildlife. So that's key, right? The key is sort of this mindset shift away from we only need to be planting turf grass to maybe it's okay to have some areas of turf grass if you need it and you want that, but also it doesn't have to be all turf grass all the time. So let's put the native plants back. Let's reduce the overall size of the lawn and start to get to really what the ecosystem would have been like before it was developed.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. And I had no idea of the ability to access a pollinator pathway. And after the show up, and I have to plug that in and see what's happening in my neighborhood.
Yeah, there's so many great resources that you can where you can find plant lists, and there's more and more native plant nurseries popping up too that really specialize in only really curating native plants for sale. It's very difficult to find them in big box retailers. I'm hoping that we'll start to see that shift. We're starting to see native plants show up, but sometimes, you know, those plants might have been treated with neonicotinoids, you know, pesticides that are systemic and can still cause problems for pollinators when we put them in the landscape. So sourcing native plants is sometimes tricky depending on where you are, but we are starting to see, I think, a kind of system-wide movement in that space, which is fantastic. I am so heartened by seeing that.
Yeah, that is encouraging. That is encouraging. Now, one of the top in the book is the idea of rethinking suburban landscapes as conservation corridors. So, you know, for those who, you know, don't have the house, you know, with the lawn, front lawn, back lawn, but maybe, like you mentioned earlier, living in an apartment or maybe just have a balcony, what can someone who is in that kind of environment do?
I'd like to tell people that no space is too small. And even if you are simply going out and putting a few potted plants on a balcony or a patio, that's still creating habitat and food for pollinators and other wildlife that might not otherwise be able to find that sort of forage elsewhere in the community. So no action is too small, but there's also some other practices that we can do. Whether you live in a house or an apartment or whether you work in a major office building, we can think about things like light pollution and how it impacts really a myriad of different species, from nocturnal insects like fireflies to birds. This time of year, a lot of our birds are migrating back north to their summer breeding grounds from where they overwintered in the south. And a lot of them are being drawn into suburban and urban neighborhoods because of light pollution. That puts them at increased risk for things like window strikes. So again, whether you live in an apartment or a home or you work in an office building, think about how you can make those windows more bird friendly. It can be as simple as going out and applying decals to the outside of the window to break up that reflection of sky or plant life so birds know, hey, this is a no-fly zone. Light pollution is another really easy thing to address, right? Shut off any outdoor unnecessary lights overnight. If you do have lights that need to stay on, changing them to a more amber-colored bulb can actually be less attractive to insects. And by making them less attractive to insects, we're also going to be drawing in fewer birds that are attracted to those insects. So some very, very easy things that we can all do. And then the last chapter of my book, it talks about kind of moving beyond the backyard. It starts to hint at some of those other kind of more actionable things that you can do that's not necessarily around gardening, but almost like getting involved politically or within your local community. If you have resources, sharing them with your local schools, voting for, you know, legislation and politicians that are going to be in support of environmental practices. If you live in an area with, let's say, a really strict HOA or you have really strict city codes about what you can plant and where, working with legislators and helping educate them on why some of those codes need to be changed can really help support the entire community.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, I live in one of those heavily HOA, regulated areas, and many times, you know, it's just a matter of them not knowing, not knowing the impact, that some vegetation have, on the environment.
Exactly, and a lot of city codes are saying things like, you can't have plants that are above, like maybe 18 inches or something, because they're seen as weeds. Well, a lot of these native plants, even things like milkweed, can sometimes, be viewed as weeds. So if you're planting something like a small micro prairie or a pocket prairie, let's say in your front yard, you might be vulnerable to some of these city codes that are going to come in and, like, you know, mow down your garden when you're not home. Same with food gardens, right? We've seen this in the news again and again over the last decade or more of people who are growing food gardens in their front yard, especially in urban areas, and the city comes in and says, well, you can't do that. And we have to ask ourselves, well, why not? Why can't we use the land to support us? Like, isn't that what it's like? Isn't that what we have to rely on, right? Like, our health is based on the ability of the land to support us, and yet we've rendered ourselves, again, just distinctly separate from it, so much so that we've actually legislated against, you know, allowing us to grow food for ourselves.
Right, I know. It's crazy. Then that's the healthy approach, you know, to be able to grow the food. I mean, I know from my experience in gardens, the vegetables grown are just so much tastier, you know, than those purchased in the store.
Right. And you think about a carbon footprint, too, of, like, food transport. You know, I talk a little bit in the book, kind of superficially, but I talk about the idea of growing your own garden, right? Growing your own food garden doesn't have to be a mutually exclusive endeavor when you think about inviting wildlife into your garden. This is something we had to learn in my suburban lot, because we have a lot of wildlife, a lot of hungry wildlife, raccoons, skunks, groundhogs, rabbits, deer, that want to eat the food that we're growing. So we had to invest in a fence, and that, you know, wasn't cheap, but now we're able to grow our own food. The land should be able to support both us as humans, because we're part of nature, while also supporting wildlife that have been here for far longer than us.
Yeah, very much. Now, part of the idea of going native, you know, with item is to eliminate invasives, you know, those species that are not, you know, native to an area. So can you talk a little bit about the impact that this kind of planting, you know, the impact that it makes on an environment?
Yeah, native plants are one of the biggest threats to biodiversity on the planet, and not just native plants, but native species in general. In the book, I talk a lot about invasive plants specifically, because many of the plants that are invasive in our landscapes are plant species that we have purposely brought here and planted because we think they're pretty. And they happen to do really, really well in our climate, in our soils, so well that they begin to outcompete native species and other gardening species. And again, not every non-native species is problematic. We have daffodils and tulips and a number of plants that are ornamentals, right? They're non-native here in the U.S., but they play nicely with others. Then there's the invasive plants that don't play nicely with anybody. They grow really aggressively. They propagate very easily and aggressively. And the one key characteristic of invasive plants is their ability to jump borders. So they don't stay in cultivated landscapes. They are able to travel, oftentimes through things like feeding of birds. You know, birds eat the berries of, let's say, the non-native honeysuckles, and then they fly miles away. And through bird dropping, they drop those seeds in a nice little packet of fertilizer, no less. And then those plants begin to propagate and grow in natural areas. So now we have forests that are absolutely filled to the brim with things like non-native multiflora rose and honeysuckles. We have, you know, meadows and grasslands filled with things like autumn olive. Our forest understories are filled with garlic mustard, which is out competing a lot of our spring ephemeral wildflowers. And our forest structures are entirely changing. Now, those native trees like oaks and hickories, for example, cannot regenerate in forest. So when the large mature trees begin to die off, what we're left with is this mid-story and understory of nothing but aggressively growing invasive plants. So we're completely changing sort of the structure and the species composition of native ecosystems, which again is contributing then to things like climate change, because these oaks and hickories, I mean, they absorb so much carbon from the atmosphere, they store them in their roots and in the soil and the ground, and then they're being replaced by nothing but invasive species that don't have that same carbon storage capacity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is because we chose to plant these things because we thought they were pretty in our home landscape, and we continue to do that. We continue to plant these things purposely because we think that they're beautiful.
Wow, yeah, I know. It's crazy. Now, when it comes to invasive plants, one of the things when I moved to the Southeast was kudzu.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just covers everything, and that was one of those that was, brought in to kind of treat a problem, but now they call it the vine that ate the South,
The
because
vine
it's
that ate the
South.
South, yeah.
Yeah. And quite honestly, sometimes it's very pretty, when it's like, as far as a landscape, kind of thing. But other than that, when you recognize what it's doing to the trees and brush, you're kind of, I mean, I sit back and, kind of just shake my head of, here we are, someone was trying to fix a problem and ended up creating a bigger one than what was there before.
Exactly. And you said something really important there, which is, sometimes we see these things and we see how aggressively they grow. One great example here in Ohio is the Bradford pear, which is now everywhere. It's super invasive. It was highly, highly utilized as a common street tree decades ago. And, I write a little story about kind of how that came to be, but they were originally bred to be sterile, a sterile variety of ornamental pear. And there were some weaknesses with, that sterile variety. So we introduced a new variety that we didn't realize could crossbreed with the sterile variety and produce viable seed. So now we have calorie pear everywhere, and in the spring it blossoms, and everybody from afar can look at it and say, oh, wow, look at that beautiful, those beautiful acres and acres of nothing but pear trees in bloom.
Mm-hmm.
But when when you know what it is and the damage that it's causing, all of a sudden it's no longer, oh, look at that beautiful landscape. It's, oh, my gosh, look at that devastated landscape. That eco-literacy, I think, is lost in a lot of people. And I talk about this idea of plant blindness in the book. As humans, we kind of go through life and we're like, oh, look at the plant. It's green. It's good. In fact, I started my career working for the National Park Service as an interpretive park ranger. And my job one season was educating park visitors about the threat of invasive plants specifically. And I would, I would, on the trail, I would turn around and look at these trees behind me and say, all these things that you're seeing are non-native. And park visitors would look at me and say, well, how can a plant be bad? A, it's just a plant. B, it's green, and green equals good.
Mm-hmm.
So we need the eco-literacy. We need the ability to identify what we're seeing, to understand, almost like reading the landscape, right? And understanding how devastating some of these species can truly be and what the ecological function should be or what has been lost because now we have all of these non-native and invasive species in place of native ones.
Yeah, very much. Now, where I live, we have some Bradford pears trees right in front of my place. But the HOA has taken a much more active, approach to try and eliminate them, to take them down and replace them with something more native than what we have. So, but yeah, in the spring they are very pretty,
mm-hmm.
But once you learn, the impact that they have, then it kind of shifts that prettiness a little bit.
It does. It really changes the story.
Yeah, very much. Now, one other aspect in your book, one particular part of the book, was the idea of leave the leaves. And so I thought that was kind of a clever title, but also to get a point across. So talk about, I'm constantly seeing people raking their yards, getting rid of the leaves. So why would one want to leave the leaves?
Yeah, so this idea of leaving the leaves has been commonly parroted again and again. I see it every fall on social media, these pleas from environmental organizations to please leave your leaves. And no matter how many stories I see about the benefits of leaves, I go out every fall, and from sunup until sundown, my neighborhood is filled with people who are mostly using two-stroke leaf blower, sometimes electric, to blow every single last leaf up and take it away to the landfill. Or we have big, companies that come through and suck them all up and then take them off to the city to be used in various projects. Leaves are habitat. If you have trees in your yard, you should have leaves. Trees have sort of perfected this whole, recycling system, right? They absorb all these nutrients from the soil, and they grow these big, beautiful leaves that, of course, photosynthesize and able to give energy to the tree to grow. In the fall, of course, as it gets cold, the leaves start to drop. The tree kind of goes into almost a stasis and begins to stop growing. Those leaves should sit at the base of the tree and be allowed to naturally decompose, which does a number of things, returns some nutrients to the soil, but it also helps to provide really stellar soil structure, which is something that's missing in a lot of our suburban and urban landscapes. A lot of the soil has been degraded. A lot of it is very highly compacted just because of the way the landscape has been developed. Those leaves, as they break down, can help restore that soil structure, and that is foundational to plant health, right? It's going to create healthier trees that are less vulnerable to pests or diseases because they're just going to be healthy. They're going to be growing in a healthy habitat. But also, leaving the leaves in and of itself is habitat for a number of different creatures who overwinter. Everything from, you know, a lot of different arthropods to spiders and insects. You know, a lot of bees and bumblebees will kind of burrow their way into the ground. Caterpillars in particular, though, I want to talk about. A lot of caterpillars, particularly moth caterpillars, of course, they lay their eggs up in the tree foliage. The eggs hatch. The little larvae or caterpillars begin to feed voraciously on the leaves. A lot of trees have evolved to withstand that sort of pressure of feeding, so this isn't something to worry about. It's natural. When it comes time to pupate, those caterpillars will come down to the ground and usually burrow into the soil, kind of right under the tree canopy. In most of our suburban and urban lots, though, what they find is really highly compacted soil, and they don't find the habitat that they need to complete their life cycle. And you might be, you know, questioning, well, why do we want moths? You know, aren't moths kind of icky, gross? Moth caterpillars in particular are critical for birds and a number of other wildlife that rely on them for nutrition. But breeding birds in particular need them to feed their offspring and to produce sort of a healthy nest of fledglings. So if we want birds, we need the bugs. And if we want the bugs, then we have to, you know, we have to be creating that whole soil ecosystem. So again, like, leaves are amazing. Trees have perfected this system of recycling. We shouldn't be messing with it. If you live in an HOA or an area where you can't just simply leave the leaves or you're worried about them killing your grass, you can do what we've done, which is kind of create these nice little bordered garden edges under the canopy. We have two great big pin oak trees in our front yard, so we have a lot of oak leaves. And we simply rake all of our leaves into those dedicated beds because it lets everybody else know, hey, we're doing this intentionally.
Right.
We're not just leaving the carpet of leaves. Sometimes we do. But depends on how lazy we are. But we actually rake them into these dedicated beds. So it looks intentional. And then we've planted those little places, those sort of understory forest beds, with a number of native forest understory plants, ferns, spicebush, witch hazel, things that will then go on and provide habitat and food for wildlife.
Wow, that's great. And great suggestion for folks who live in, you know, areas that are ruled by HOAs.
Yeah.
One of the, also there was in your book, you had an interesting kind of, you know, you have like little side notes, I guess, and a little kind of pop-up sections. one of them talked about starting a nature journal.
Yeah.
So I know quite a few people journaling, you know, and as a kind of a form of, you know, meditation, therapy, just because. But I don't think I've ever heard of anyone doing a nature journal. So can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts behind that?
I think that nature journaling gives us almost like a mental space to be very intentional about slowing down and going out into the landscape and just observing. You know, we live in a very busy, busy, busy culture. Everybody has to stay busy all the time. And if you're not busy, you're probably scrolling on your phone and trying to keep your mind and your hands busy doing something. And I think, you know, it's one thing to tell people, hey, just go out and sit in your yard and observe things around you. Observe the different bee species that are visiting the flowers. Observe what's even in bloom. You know, observe the plant life and how animals are interacting with your landscape, how the sun moves across your landscape. It's very difficult, I think, for us to just slow down and do that. Nature journaling provides us sort of this pathway for doing just that, while kind of keeping our mind and our hands busy, but doing so in a way that's also contributing to a better, sort of more informed understanding of what's happening out there in our yards. And it also can kind of create this then record too of what you're seeing at certain times of the year, which can inform, oh, hey, I know that this little insect or maybe this plant, you know, blooms at a certain time, or this insect emerges at a certain time. And I know within a couple of weeks of feeding on these leaves, it's going to complete its life cycle and it's going to go away. And this plant is going to be A-okay. So I don't have to go out and like treat it with pesticide. So it kind of allows us to create almost like this written record of what's happening in the landscape and then see how things shift over time. see how our efforts to restore ecosystem function, it is changing and how our efforts are making a difference.
Yeah, great. Now, another section in your book was Become a Backyard Scientist.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I noticed is in the film that you have on your website, you know, you had a couple of the kids collecting bugs. You know, one young girl says she collected several kinds of spiders and she used to be afraid of them, but now they're interesting, you know. But I also noticed that, in your book too, that you try and not, interrupt an insect, or remove an insect from its environment.
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell us a little bit about the balance, between that and maybe how parents can stimulate, the interest in their children in the backyard bugs?
Yeah, so we want to obviously keep the habitat as intact as possible. I do obviously a lot of macro photography, so I'm getting kind of up close and personal with insects, but when I photograph them, I'm photographing them on site and what we call in situ. So I'm photographing them without manipulating them, I'm not an entomologist, I'm not collecting, I'm not killing, I'm not freezing, which sometimes are common practices, I think, in both photography, but certainly in scientific endeavor too. When we think about this idea of like backyard science and really community science, we're inviting homeowners, apartment owners, pretty much anyone in the community, kids and adults alike, to go out into nature, make observations. It could be as simple as using your smartphone to take photos that you upload to an app like iNaturalist, which starts to give especially scientists and researchers a bigger picture of things like species distribution. And you might find that, there's this species that we're seeing a northern shift in because of the warming climate. Or maybe we're starting to see fewer observations of this other particular thing, maybe at a certain time of year, because of things happening out in the landscape. So there's so many different ways to get involved. There are programs that allow you to go out and observe backyard birds. There are programs for lady beetles and fireflies and monarchs and bees and pretty much anything that you might be interested in. There's also tons of like local programs that might invite you out to look at, fish or reptiles or amphibians, like whatever you're interested in, plant blooms and timing of plant blooms and phenology. So many different ways to get involved. And as a mother of two kids myself, I have an 8 and 10-year-old boys, seeing their interest in nature and being a mentor for sort of their learning about and love of nature is like the greatest thing that I could ever accomplish in this life, is creating this next generation of conservationists.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. And generally speaking, boys tend to really have that curiosity.
They do. They have a lack of fear.
Yeah,
for better or for worse.
Yeah, exactly. So what is it that you hope that people will take away from reading your book?
My biggest hope is that people will get the book and walk away with that first step. I think that gardening for wildlife can sometimes feel overwhelming and very, it just feels to some people almost impractical. Like, what difference am I actually making in my little garden? And I hope that people can read the book and walk away with a sense of empowerment where maybe they didn't have that before. And they walk away with I tell people it's almost like a choose your own adventure. You can open it up to any chapter, read just that chapter, and then walk away with a few practices that you can implement right away. And when you're ready, whether it's financially ready, mentally ready, emotionally ready, you can, dive into the next chapter and start there. But really, I think the biggest thing that I hope people walk away with is almost just this reevaluation of our relationship to nature and recognizing that we as humans are part of nature and we can garden and landscape in ways that invite us back into that really important relationship with this world that supports our health as humans while also supporting the health of creatures and plant life all over the world.
Yeah, that's great. And quite honestly, I believe your book will do that. It is very practical and people can start using the suggestions immediately, to start making changes. And it does not take much effort to do that. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, it's your photography is awesome. You know, and, you know, when you get those macro pictures of those bugs, I mean, they look complex.
Yeah, they're beautiful, and it's worth taking a second look at bugs. When we see them, we see their faces and their eyes and their behavior. I think it really starts to break down fear, and it gets replaced with curiosity and wonder, and that's needed more than ever. That curiosity and awe and wonder and just appreciation is needed, because that will compel conservation action.
Absolutely. Well, this has really been a treat, Danae. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us.
This conversation was so fun. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, on social media, you're on which platforms?
You can find me at Chasing Bugs on Facebook, TikTok, and Blue Sky, and Chasing Bugs 1 on Instagram, or at chasingbugs.com.
Great. That's wonderful. And I know that I've followed you on a couple of them, and by afternoon, I'll be following you on all the rest. So,
great.
So again, thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And again, your book is wonderful.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Danae Wolf. We've been talking about her new book, Grass Isn't Greener, The Everyday Conservationist's Guide to Bringing Nature to Your Yard. And as I mentioned, you can find out more about that, as well as all the other things that Danae has available, by visiting her website, which is chasingbugs.com. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for today's episode of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.